Welcome to Motivated to Lead podcast, helping you become a better leader. I'm your host, Mark Klingsheim. Hi, everyone. Thanks again for joining us for our podcast this week. My name is Mark Klingsheim with SEMA Partners. Each week, we interview leaders and they share lessons learned from their careers. Our goal is to help you become a better leader. This week, we're revisiting the conversation that we had early on in our podcast with Janine Sheehan. Janine is the Executive Vice President and Chief Administrative and HR Officer for InfuSystem. She has a background with working in large companies as well as VC-funded startups. She has some great things to share around career and managing your career as well as leadership. And looking forward to our conversation today with Janine. I guess first off, Janine, can you give us just a little bit of your background and your career, a little bit of your history?
Happily. Thanks for having me, Mark. So I will start with where I am today, and then I'll start over and share some of my early journeys with you.
Sure.
So I just started. Actually, I'm in week four at a medical device company called InfuSystem. And I am in the capacity of Chief Administrative Officer. And it's pretty cool because part of what we're talking about today is the journey and the career path and how people get to where they are. And so this will be certainly leading the HR function, which I know is the broader part of your audience for this particular podcast. But it also will dovetail into broader work, which is really fun. So things like mergers and acquisitions and board work, which is always really cool, particularly for CHRO. So where I started is interesting, right out of school. I started at Accenture, which used to be Anderson Consulting, and I started in an administrative capacity. And then I followed that to Digitas, formerly Bronner Schlossberg. And I have to say, starting my career in an administrative capacity was extremely beneficial because it serves me even today. So being able to, you know, whip your way around Microsoft products, whether it's PowerPoint, Word, Excel, and just having those administrative skills is a huge value add. And it also opened a lot of doors for me too, because the executives that I supported at the time saw a lot of the potential that I had just by some of the work that I did. So that's how I started my career. And when I was in my final administrative assistant position, I supported human resources. And I got my first generalist position, worked my way up, and then went to larger companies. And then I took a completely radical shift. So I had worked at large publicly traded companies. And then I looked back, I had enrolled in business school and I was ready to make a change. And I said, okay, what is something that I've never done? So I've worked at large publicly traded companies as middle line manager, director.
Sure.
And I had seen companies go public. I had seen them go private. Had helped in that process. But what I hadn't done is I hadn't worked for a private equity or VC-backed company that was just going through their series, say, C, and in hypergrowth. And so that was the job that I just recently had with a company called Crimson Hexagon. They were still are a PE-backed company, around $45 million in revenues, very high growth plans, funded by multiple sets of investors, and they had just finished their Series C when I joined. So I'll pause there for a minute and make sure I'm answering your question as I
absolutely going. So one of the questions we ask every executive that we interview is, knowing what you know now and looking back on your career, is there anything particular that you would tell your 22-year-old self if you could go back in time? And what advice would you give?
I would say this might sound a little, I don't know. It's okay to start at the bottom and work your way up, and that you shouldn't underestimate the value of the skill set you learn starting at a very junior position and working your way up. And I know that's hard today because we have so many tools at our disposal, and in fairness, the curve is faster now, and with that goes expectations. But I think it's fair to say that there's a lot of power and value that comes in those tools that you learn in positions that are more junior than what you feel you may be ready for.
So going back to you've had large company experience. Tell me a little bit as far as that transition to more of a startup VC funded type organization. What things would you tell somebody about that transition and what advice would you give somebody in that
move? So there's a lot there. I mean, the quick of it would be that when you come from a large company, public or private, there are processes in place, whether it's people, processes, systems, procurement, finance and accounting. Their processes are very, very much established, especially if it's a seasoned company. When you go to a smaller entrepreneurial company, particularly those that are in early stages, even late stage companies that are founding CEOs, they wouldn't have survived in their entrepreneurial stage if they did have a ton of process and a ton of political tape, as you will. And yet your job is to come into that company. The reason they go after someone that has that large company experience and bring them in is they want you to take that experience and help this company grow. They want you to put processes and procedures in place. And you have to be careful how you do it, because you don't want to break the culture. You don't want to kill that sort of entrepreneurial spirit and zest, but at the same time, you've got to put a code of conduct in. Or, you know, drinking beer at your desk at 2 o'clock is just not a good idea when you are experiencing, say, volatility in the market or whatever.
Sure.
Business is in a downturn. So the balance of it is that you have to find a way to do that in a way that is efficient and doesn't take too long, but that's authentic and takes the culture with it versus kind of breaks it and tears it apart.
Got it. Tell me about your thoughts around the HR role being a strategic partner. I think years ago, HR was considered just a function that wasn't really at the table, but today that's changed. Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about your thoughts and your experience around that.
Yeah, so I have very strong opinions. Anyone that listens to this that knows me knows how I feel about that topic, so thank you for raising it. It's interesting. I was in HR. I had just started in HR back when it was more that personnel function, highly transactional, very rarely seat at the table. You know, the HR EVP would report into the CAO or CFO or the president. Today it's different, and you know, we've earned our seat at the table, and you have to continue to add value and you have to continue to show up. To me, what I see, and I think this is how I ended up in this role that I'm in now as CAO, is it's so much more than just owning the people function. It's making sure that the employees understand how the work that they do ties to business outcomes. And how does that happen? So it doesn't matter what their role is. It doesn't matter what their rank is in an organization, whether it's indirect or direct, everybody, the contribution that they make and the value that they create should somehow tie to how the business is performing or not performing. And so the strategic role in HR, in my opinion, is really helping thread that needle and helping the employees understand where that value creation is. And then the other part of it, the more simple part of it, in concept at least, is when I'm at the table, I don't just talk about people topics. I'm asking questions on the P&L. I understand how to read a balance sheet. I'm asking questions in areas of the business that I don't really need to. And I feel that as a business partner, which everyone on this call will relate to, how am I going to do a good job supporting the sales organization or the market, the go-to-market strategy, or the product roadmap, if I don't understand what it is they're doing? So part of it is really understanding the company and how it works, and it really sets you off for much greater success as a business partner too, because you get how the company works.
So is that an education process? Some companies are further along in that thought process, and how do you influence that?
That's a tough one because there are still a lot of organizations that look at the people function in sort of, and I don't really like to use the word old school, but they look at it in more of an archaic way. So to me, the most important thing is when a company decides to hire a CHRO, that's usually a good indication that they're ready. I would say the key is you've got to have a strong team. There's no longer any room for B or C players. You've got to have an A team, and the leaner your team, the higher they've got to be in terms of their competency. And you've got to have people that are curious, because what will happen is if you've got that intellectual curiosity in your team, and you've got that competency, it becomes a little more organic, so that you're not at the table saying, well, why wouldn't you want to invite me to more than just the ceremony? I want to go to the reception. Sure. So to me, that value and that transition that you just talked about, unfortunately, it can't be deliberate. It's got to just be in the organization seeing what you're doing. And then hopefully the invitation comes. And if it doesn't, then you're at the wrong party.
Well, Janine, can you give us some of your thoughts around inclusion and some of the teachings and learnings that you've had at Cornell?
And the lessons that I learned on that were at Cornell through Professor Lisa Nietzsche. And the concept there that I feel very acutely, I feel it myself, even in the current organization where there's room to grow, is that there's this idea that companies still focus so much today on diversity and checking the box and the sociodemographics, or making sure that they go after a certain population in the workforce that either makes them look better or makes them feel like they're hitting all the D&I checkboxes. And so what I've learned both through my coursework, but also in my own experiences, is that the I is vastly missing still in many organizations. And it's nobody's fault necessarily. It's these biases that we all hold, where we hire people that look like us, that act like us, that behave like us, that talk like us, have the same type of profile that we have common interests. And the problem there is that if you go and hire people that have that, or you, worse, you try to check a box and hire people that are different than that because you want to be a diverse company, then you don't pull through on the inclusion side. And so what that means is that the only way people can succeed is if they're not themselves. So I can only last in my department if I change who I am to be able to fit in with my boss, or I change my style of working so that my boss can appreciate the work that I'm doing. And that's that inclusion piece that I had mentioned the other day that I feel is still greatly lacking. And it doesn't matter how much D&I work you do, you can go hire a D&I consultant. If you don't focus on the I and on the inclusion and making sure that people can shine and thrive and that their brains light up just by being who they are, and all that front end work you've done is just wasted work. And then you end up losing people and they leave really upset because you've not been honest with them through the process.
Well, Janine, you know, one of the questions that has been poised for a number of years is around being a woman in business and the barriers that are there. Do you think the barriers are still there today?
Yeah, it's a great question. And it actually is a great dovetail from the diversity and inclusion questions. I do. And it's interesting. I remember about a year ago listening to a podcast, actually, on this very topic. And, you know, I've read all the Sheryl Sandberg books. I've always been an avid believer in pushing through that ceiling. And there was a time when I thought, okay, well, we're perpetuating the problem by talking about it. But you know what? I don't think that's true. I've seen a lot in the last 6 months in particular at the companies I've been at, my prior company and this company that I'm at today, where I still see that happening. I still see, whether it's a board meeting, whether it's an executive meeting, I still see that either I observe it or at times I feel it myself, where I have to be a little more vocal than, say, my counterpart in expressing an opinion or being asked for my opinion. And so I would tell you that I think some companies do a better job on it, particularly if they focus on it. So, for example, there are companies that specifically go after, you know, female board members, because they have a highly male-dominated board. But if I go back to that inclusion piece, if they don't do a good enough job ensuring that that person that joins can succeed, then it doesn't work. So yes, I do think that there are still barriers. I still feel them, although I don't feel them as acutely as I think the generation before us probably did.
Tell me a little bit as far as you're staying current in your role and continuing to learn and develop. Are there any books that you've read lately or in the past that you think would be great resources for people listening to the podcast?
There are. So but to answer the first question, I think it's an important one. When I went back for my executive master's, that's part of the reason why I did it, Mark, was because I felt like I was flat. I felt like I wasn't learning a lot of on-the-job learning, but I was losing that intellectual curiosity for myself. So that's part of the reason why I went back to school. I would encourage people, especially emerging leaders, when it feels like you're at your busiest and it's the last time you'd want to go back to school or pick up a book or go to a seminar, join, you know, HRLF or SHRM or another network, NARA, there's plenty of them. Mm-hmm. That's the time when you should do it. That's the time when you should stoke that curiosity. As far as books, there's one, I've read many of them. I don't have as many as you have in your bookshelf, Mark. My favorite is Fierce by Susan Scott. I think she started the company out of Portland. And it is now an instructor-led series. You can get certified on it as well. And it's all about coming up from behind yourself and making the conversation real. And being able to, whether it's conflict mastery, whether it's personal or professional challenges you have, it's all about the relationship and that every conversation you have counts. So Susan Scott, Fierce, and again, they've got an amazing learning program too that you can bring into your organization.
Talk a little bit, you know, we heard so many years ago, back when I first started in executive search, mm-hmm. the war for talent was a big issue. And it seems like that continues today as far as with the record unemployment rates and companies really struggling to get right people in the right spots. Tell me a little bit about your thoughts around the war for talent and how do companies deal with that?
It's a big problem. And there's a few reasons why it is. So it's certainly the employment rate. And you know, we talked the other day that it's at a record low, but also for an extraordinary period of time. So that's your first hurdle. But the other hurdle that I think is worth discussion is the population. So now we have a highly driven millennial population where loyalty means something very different than what it looked like even 10 years ago. And that's going to continue to shift. And so what I mean by that is that your employee could be as engaged as possible, and you still are lucky if you get 3 to 5 years out of them. And so that's your challenge, is it doesn't matter how engaged you keep your workforce. I mean, it matters. But when it comes to this topic, the clock is ticking the minute they start. And so you have that, you have the unemployment rate being at an all-time low. You've got a population that turns much more frequently, and they're curious, so they're constantly on the move. And so as far as how you compete against the war for talent, to me, it feels like it's all about your employee brand, right? So if you think about a company that invests a ton of money into marketing, and the best companies do, your employee brand is your internal marketing, internal to get your external people, of course. And what I mean by that is, what types of programs are you putting in place to go after that passive talent population? Because they're not applying for jobs. They're not going through Indeed. They're being plucked from organizations in most cases. So what do you use? Do you use LinkedIn? What is your strategy? How do you recruit? How do you hunt for that talent? And you know what that's like. And then once you get them, what are you doing to differentiate yourself as an employer versus another company? And once you get that person on the phone, sure, you have got a great opportunity to sell. But until you get them on the phone, you've got to make sure your LinkedIn company profile is really exciting and provocative to the extent it can be. And then once they go onto your careers page, what's there? How do you excite that candidate just like you would a shopper going on a website? If you think through that, how many people are clicking through and what type of caliber are you getting? And then once you get them in the door, Mark, it's really about taking that employee branding and that value prop inside and coming up with key retention levers to keep that talent as long as you can. But the war never stops. It's just really about what you can do to keep your talent as long as you can.
The retention part of it is definitely an issue. And as you mentioned, with the next generation workers, that they look at work differently as far as it's more of a, almost like a project versus a lifetime.
That's of interesting. Service. Yeah.
So, you know, how do companies engage as far as kind of, is it more that giving them a mission?
Oh, it's a great question. And I have to tell you, I haven't figured it all out. What I can tell you is the experience that I've had, again, having an extremely strong HR team and being privileged to work with really good executives, is you don't shut them out. So we're talking about millennials, right? Because that's where your highest risk is. You don't want to shut them out. I mean, one of my biggest pet peeves is when I hear executives say, well, they don't know what they're doing. They're 32. They have no experience. They just don't get it. And it's like, well, they're going to be your boss in a couple of years. So you better help them get it. But I think it's about, they want a voice. So, you know, when I really break it down and I think about how I was 10 years ago, I wanted a raise and I wanted a different position and I wanted an opportunity. I had the same thoughts they have. I just didn't have the strength or the courage, or it wasn't appropriate to voice it. But my mind didn't think any differently. So the only difference is now, other than their pace is a little bit quicker, because the opportunities, I mean, there's a million high-tech companies. Those companies didn't exist years ago.
Sure.
Is that they have more courage. They're raised by different, you know, parents. They're raised in a culture that they, whether it's social media or any other platform, they're asked constantly for their opinion. And so they don't differentiate that in the workplace. So I think it's important to leverage that. The other point that I would make is, don't go too far, meaning a lot of companies are also swinging the pendulum on the other side to say the aging population still adds a ton of value. And when you think about solving complex business issues and you have a company that has the average tenure of 2 years and the average employee age of 26, and you can't figure out why you're not solving complex business issues, that could be part of your issue. And so what we tend to do is encourage companies to balance that and don't underestimate the value that someone that maybe on the other side of the spectrum could add in helping solve company issues. So the idea is to actually help bond and blend these different groups versus segment them out. And if you look at some companies today that aren't doing well, that's what they do. You've got all these gens looking at each other like the other doesn't know what's going on. And if you could get them to work better together, it would be a really good story.
That's good. What mistakes do you think a lot of hiring managers make that could be avoided? And sometimes it's a matter of, you know, whether it's the process that's involved, but things that you've noticed as far as in your years with different companies, what are some things that you've said could be taken care of if we put the right emphasis on the hiring process?
Oh, so the hiring process, I would say, if we're talking about recruiting, the biggest issue that candidates face today and the feedback that I've heard for years is I sat in a room and I had five different people ask me the same question. Or the questions they asked were really archaic questions about, tell me about a time when you had a challenge doing X, instead of, here's a business issue that we're facing at the company that you're considering. How would you handle it? So it's more relevant. It's more tangible. It gives both parties an ability to get to know the other person's context. So part of it is, and we rolled this out at Crimson Hexagon. I don't deserve any credit because I didn't develop it. But it was a process where we trained the interviewers, whether it was a panel, and each of them had training on how to interview, training how to not talk too much, training on how to listen, and also asking different questions so that the candidate was able to have the best experience. And then each of, say, the four or five people interviewing the candidate were able to figure out for themselves as a team, as they calibrated, did they have the right person? So that's the experience piece. The problem from a process perspective, the problem that I see hiring managers continue to make, again, goes back to the diversity and inclusion. They've got these unintentional biases, particularly managers that are very seasoned and tenured, And I've seen it a lot in sales organizations where they just hire people that are cut from the same cloth as they are. That can add a lot of value too. Hiring a known entity can be really good, right? But you lose out on this population that could help you deliver against your goals in a better way. And then the other part of it is you tend to really let the employee down if you've hired someone and they don't live up to your expectations, and maybe your expectations are unrealistic or bias-based.
And looking at the interview process, and you've mentioned as far as some of the interview questions have been asked over and over, and most candidates have experienced those. Are there any that you feel are worth asking in an interview setting that you think get to kind of a core of who a person is?
I actually, so I'm a little non-traditional. I don't believe in asking questions in interviews that are scripted. In other words, anybody, especially if they're canned questions, I'm going to come in with a canned response. So the best way, if you're a really good HR practitioner, you've got a good gut. And so just by having a conversation, now you don't want it to be unstructured completely. You don't want to just chat about how your Sunday went. But if you go in and talk about business challenges, or say to someone, you know, tell me a little bit about your experience at your last company. You know, what were some of the things that drove you crazy? What were some of the things that you feel really, really good about? Kind of like the questions you're asking me. If this was an interview, you would have a really good idea based on what I've talked about, whether or not I could do the job. And yet none of them are specifically, how would you handle this exact situation? Or it doesn't feel canned, it's conversational. I find that that is how I'm able to figure out whether someone's going to be a fit. I'm able to figure out whether they're authentic and whether or not they're just telling me what I want to hear. And because it's completely unscripted, a little structured, but unscripted, we're both very comfortable with each other because that person can be themselves. Mm-hmm. That person can just share who they are, what they're excited to do, and it goes a lot better. The worst thing you can do, and I see interviewers do it all the time, is do all the talking. I've also had that happen where the interviewer, you know, I just recently interviewed, by the way, it was about 4 months ago, and it was a CHRO job. And this is important. And I met with about 15 people, and that alone over 2 days was exhausting. So it was 2 days, 15 people. Wow. And I might've talked for about 45 minutes in total. So there's no need to go any further on what that experience was,
sure.
But I knew that it wasn't the right job for me.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things that one of the people that I've worked with for years always talks about with finalist candidates is that they always want to have them somewhere outside of the office, whether it's for a dinner or for mm-hmm. something to get people out of the setting, just because he said typically people do not let down their guard until they're outside of an interview setting. And he does that with all of his, at least one meeting that's offsite. Tell me about just how many interviews do you think to get to that final decision? You know, there's some companies that overdo it. Maybe we're out the candidates. You want to make sure that you're making the right decision. Any thoughts around that as far as from your experience?
I'd say quickly, it depends, right? I think if, you know, what you don't want to do is have one or two and put your candidate in front of a panel of 15 people, right? But on the flip side, it's like getting married after a couple of dates. It's really hard. So you want to be thorough enough. So I would say if you're going to have more of those interviews, then I agree with you. You change up the setting. You tell them not to wear a suit, especially if that's what your culture offers from a dress perspective. You welcome them in so that they understand that you're not bringing them back for the ringer. You're bringing them back so that you can both continue to learn more. So I would say if you set expectations, and they don't feel like you're using them just as you figure out other candidates, then you can have them come back four or five times. But then again, you really have to put rigor into your process, make sure they're not ever asked the same question twice. And then it's okay to do multiple interviews, in my opinion.
What advice would you give a new executive who is putting together his first executive team? Any thoughts around that? Some things to look for?
Oh, change it up. I would say make it a room of people that are really different from one another. And I have that at the current company I just joined. It's so, in my last company too, it was just so refreshing. And people would challenge the CEO, you know, straight talk with respect. I learned that at my last company and it was just so refreshing. And we were all able to get so much more done because we were able to leave our egos at the door, literally. And I would give that advice to any CEO is make sure you've got A players, never settle. And make sure you bring people on that can politely push back to help you be a better CEO.
That's good. Any parting advice that you would give someone as they're either in their early part of their career or maybe they're in their mid-career?
The advice I would give there is the learning piece that we just touched on. I can't express enough how much my brain has lit up over the last few years through my coursework, through being invited back to write and do the, I did the Ask the Expert series on the workforce analytics and executive comp, which forced me to write. And it forced me to do these videos where I had to record them five times because I kept saying, go to networking events where you have to walk around with a name tag and you have to force yourself to meet someone that you've never met before. It is the most awkward moment ever, but you walk out feeling really good about yourself. And then finally, to your point earlier, read a book, do your podcasts, keep learning, because the fact that I'm doing this right now, my CEO is in the other room, I kicked him out, and he's so supportive. And any executive selfishly will love to see their leader doing things like this. And oh, by the way, it closes with your first question, which is your pathing and how you have a seat at the table beyond just HR. This is how you do it.
Great. Well, thanks, Janine. I appreciate your thoughts. And this is really a lot of fun.
Yeah, I had a lot of fun too. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Motivated to Lead podcast. Please subscribe on iTunes. You can also see a video version of this interview at motivatedtolead.com. This podcast is brought to you by SEMA Partners, helping you find your next great leader.